and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the wake-up call that the Republicans will win back the House in 2022 before one vote is cast because of the gerrymandering underway following the recent census. They will pick up 2 seats in Texas and North Carolina, and 2 more in Georgia and Florida, with another in Kansas, Kentucky, Tennessee, and New Hampshire, for a total of 12 when they only need 5 to win back the House. Joining us to discuss how our democracy is withering and dying and is about to disappear slowly, legally, and in plain sight is David Daley, a senior fellow for Fair Vote and the author of Rateffed, The True Story Behind the Plan to Steal America's Democracy, and Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. We'll discuss his article at The Guardian, Republicans Can Win the Next Elections Through Gerrymandering Alone, and the extent to which Democrats are limited in gerrymandering states they control, even if they wanted to take off the gloves, because of fair play laws that have created independent redistricting commissions in California, Washington, and New Jersey, and are in the process of creating them in Colorado, Oregon, and Virginia. Then we'll examine the possibility that the U.S. could pull out all of its troops from the Middle East and not just Afghanistan, which the Biden administration plans to do in September. Eugene Goltz, a professor of political science at Notre Dame who served in the Pentagon as a senior advisor to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manufacturing and Industrial Base, joins us to discuss his new report at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Nothing Much to Do, Why America Can Bring All Troops Home from the Middle East. Then finally, we'll speak with Madia Afzal, who is a fellow in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution, whose research lies at the intersection of political economy, development, and security with a focus on Pakistan. She is the author of Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society, and the State, and joins us to discuss her recent article at the Washington Post, What the Biden Administration's Narrative on Afghanistan Gets Wrong. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, David Daley, who's a senior fellow for Fair Vote and the author of Rateffed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, as well as Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. And he has an article at The Guardian, Republicans Can Win the Next Election Through Gerrymandering Alone. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Daley.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you mentioned, as the title suggests in your piece in The Guardian, that Republicans could win the next election through gerrymandering alone. It's not like that's the only arrow in their quiver. They have 4 concurrent strategies. 1 is gerrymandering. 2 is voter suppression. 3 is, after the votes are cast, they then, through partisan Republican legislatures, they get to count and certify the vote. And the 4th strategy is to harass election workers to the point where many are quitting. A poll recently indicated half of election workers feel threatened. And if they drive out these independent, neutral election workers, then they replace them with a kind of crackpot QAnon types that are doing the bogus audit in Arizona. So if they can win by gerrymandering alone, I guess that doesn't mean they're going to give up on their other strategies as well.
No, I think that's right. And I think what you're painting is an accurate and dark portrait of the state of American democracy and the crisis that we face right now. I would suggest that gerrymandering is in many ways the original sin and the ground zero of some of the other strategies that you have correctly identified. When Republicans in this last redistricting cycle back in 2011 locked themselves into power in so many states around the country, they took over and entrenched themselves in office in Wisconsin, in Georgia, in Texas, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina. And really, when you look at the voter suppression bills that have been passed, it neatly dovetails with the states that Republicans have gerrymandered into oblivion and where representative democracy is now all but unrecognizable. The first thing they do once they gerrymander themselves into power is to then embark on all of these other strategies to ensure that there is absolutely zero way for them to ever get kicked out of office. It's dangerous, it's un-American, and we're in a real crisis moment.
Well, the often used phrase is that politicians should not get to choose their voters. Voters are supposed to choose their politicians. But clearly, the Republicans have changed that. And as your article at The Guardian, Republicans can win the next election through gerrymandering alone, David Daley, indicates that in this upcoming 2022 election, midterm elections, the Republicans could create at least two additional red seats in Texas and North Carolina, another certain two in Georgia and Florida, and they could also nab another one in Kansas, Kentucky, Tennessee, and New Hampshire. And that would be enough to put them over the top, given the current narrow margin that the Democrats control the House by.
That's exactly right. I think the numbers in this case are really stark and really clear. Democrats won the national popular vote for the U.S. Congress by 4.7 million votes in 2020. Now, of course, we don't use a popular vote for much of anything, let alone electing members of Congress. But if you want to compare that to the last time that the Republicans won a similar margin, if you go back to 2014, one of the Tea Party waves, Republicans won the national popular vote by about 4.3 million in 2014. And they came away from that election with 247 seats to the Democrats' 188. So that's 59-seat difference. When Democrats won 4.7 million more votes, they come away with 223 seats. So much of that is the power of gerrymandering. So all you have to do is say, well, if everybody were to vote exactly the same way as they did in 2020, if nothing changes, you get the same distribution of votes, you would likely see, you know, I think it's almost inarguable that the 12 seats that you just identified, Texas, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, Kentucky, Kansas, Tennessee, New Hampshire, those seats would go a different way simply with the new district lines that Republicans in those states are ready to enact over the course of the next several months. You could have yet another branch of government here under the sway of this permanent Republican minority rule.
And of course, as your article points out, Republicans already benefit from a structural advantage in the Electoral College and in the United States Senate, and that presidents that lost the popular vote have appointed five conservative justices to the Supreme Court. And now they have a supermajority, with three having been appointed by Trump, who lost by 3 million. And again, in the most recent election, lost by over 7 million. So in terms of what the Democrats can do, I did speak to somebody recently who said that the Democrats should go all out and do exactly what the Republicans are doing and gerrymander the hell out of states where they control legislatures. But your article points out that they don't really have too many options, even if they wanted to play dirty like the Republicans, because in Colorado, Oregon, Virginia, the Democrats have created an independent redistricting commission. And then, of course, in California and in Washington and New Jersey, they've already had these redistricting commissions that have created independent redistricting through, usually in California, through a group of retired judges. So do the Democrats have the option of taking the gloves off and playing as dirty as the Republicans are in terms of gerrymandering?
I don't think the math is there. If Democrats wanted to go scorched earth, there's only a handful of seats that they would pick up in the process. I could see how they might gain one seat in Illinois. I could see how they could conceivably decide to draw an 8-0 map in Maryland instead of the current 7-1 map. And they could pick up a handful of seats in New York, depending on how dirty they want to play and how they want to carve out New York City. But there's not a lot of other states where you can see where Democrats could make gains via gerrymandering. As you point out, there is going to be an independent commission drawing these lines in Virginia, which is otherwise a Democratic trifecta state. Colorado is a Democratic trifecta state. They will have a commission drawing those lines, so there's no funny business that Democrats can get up to. There in Oregon, Democrats have a trifecta, but they bargained away a redistricting in order to get Republicans to come to the table and negotiate on policy issues. There are commissions already of some sort in New Jersey, in Washington State, in California, all of these other Democratic trifecta states. So if Democrats wanted to take the gloves off, they still can't come close to the number of seats that Republicans can steal directly through redrawing lines.
And again, I'm speaking with David Daley, who is a senior fellow for FairVote and the author of Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, as well as Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. And he has an article at The Guardian, Republicans Can Win the Next Elections Through Gerrymandering Alone. So given that the Republicans in the Senate blocked the For the People Act, and now it's sort of doubtful as to what strategies can be employed. And of course, President Biden seems to have been distracted by trying to get an infrastructure package through, by a new crime bill, etc. But given what we've talked about so far in this interview, David, and I've brought it up in previous interviews as well, to the point where I think some of our listeners are getting tired of me saying that the Republicans would rather cheat than compete. It's just the writing is on the wall. The Democrats should have their hair on fire. And not that Biden's got a lot of hair left, but what do you think they can do?
No, I'm with you. I think that the lack of urgency that has been shown by the Democratic Party, given the reality of the situation and the repeated willingness of Republicans to say exactly what they're going to do in 2022, and the writing on the wall as far as 2024, with, as you mentioned, some of these new election boards in states coming under the control of Republicans in state legislatures who believe in the big lie of voter fraud in 2020. When you see so many state legislatures beginning to talk about giving themselves power over electors, I don't think we're all that far away from a moment in which gerrymandered legislatures in some of these swing states begin to carve up electoral college votes in such a way as to gerrymander that even further in their advantage. So yes, Democrats need to have their hair on fire right now. Because if Republicans are able to gerrymander the House in 2022, Democrats might not get it back for another decade. Republicans have the structural advantage in the U.S. Senate, and they have increased structural advantages in the Electoral College that may be enhanced before the next election. So if Democrats don't understand that this is the moment that they have to make structural change, to do serious electoral reform, and that they might not get another one, this needs to be the top priority, and they need to get that they might not get another chance, that American democracy, as we come to know it, I know it sounds hyperbolic, but you can't look at what's coming out of state legislatures around this country and not recognize that it's true. We might not recognize American democracy after the 2024 elections if Democrats don't use this brief moment that they have of trifecta power to set things on a fair plane again. They do it or else. This truly is how democracy withers and dies in plain sight.
And in the 2022 elections, if it goes according to plan, then Biden will be completely crippled for the last 2 years of his term.
I think that's right. We saw what happened to Barack Obama after the Republican gerrymander of the U.S. House in 2012. The very night that Barack Obama was reelected president of the United States, Republicans took back the U.S. House, even though Democrats won 1.4 million more votes nationally. And all of a sudden, Republicans were able to shut down the government, to run 50 different repeal votes on Obamacare. Obama was able to accomplish next to nothing legislatively in his second term. He was really only able to govern through executive order. And as we saw, as soon as the next president took office, those executive orders can be undone rather quickly by a new president of another party. Democrats have got to understand the nature of the opposition. You're absolutely right when you say this is a party that would rather cheat than compete. They are doing this on a massive scale in state legislatures around the country. They have put an entire caucus in place in Washington in which the majority of Republican members of the U.S. House are essentially in an insurrection caucus that were willing to vote against the authorization of elections in Pennsylvania and in Arizona that were completely legitimate and certified by state officials. And they were unwilling to do this even after an insurrection that very day in the U.S. Capitol in their very workplace. Democrats are up against an authoritarian menace against a party that has lost faith not only in democracy, but in their own ability to win elections without entrenching themselves huge advantages at the get-go. They will not recognize the legitimacy of victories by the other side. And if Democrats don't get that something has changed in our politics, that something fundamentally dangerous is afoot, and that they have a brief moment right now to act and do something about it, then I fear for what's left of this republic.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, David, what do you think Merrick Garland's efforts at the DOJ will do? He's suing Georgia, and he's talking about going after other states and trying to do something about the intimidation of poll workers. So what can be achieved through the DOJ?
You know, one of the things that Joe Biden really got right is some of the legal professionals and civil rights professionals that he put in charge of voting rights in the DOJ, folks like Kristen Clark, real heroes who have been on the right side of this fight for a long time. So I think challenging these laws with the full force of the Department of Justice is going to be a very, very important tool. Now, of course, it's very hard to say what happens to these challenges in a judiciary that Republicans have stacked in their favor over the course of the last 4 years. What happens if this challenge makes its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which has become increasingly hostile to voting rights under this Chief Justice? we are about 8 years out from the catastrophic decision of Shelby County versus Holder that undid a Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which would have kept a lot of these state laws in check, right? If states had still been subject to the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act when they had a history of prejudice and racism in their election laws, these changes in Georgia and Arizona would not have been possible. But now what we have is a U.S. Supreme Court that has been willing to toss out Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. This week, there is a very important case from Arizona that is probably going to be decided by this court that has Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act in its crosshairs. So what I worry is that even though Attorney General Garland and his team might have absolutely the right idea and they might make real wins in lower courts, that by the time those challenges reach John Roberts and his ideological wrecking crew of robed partisans on the U.S. Supreme Court, those gains as well could be in jeopardy.
Well, David Daly, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
A pleasure. I wish I could be more optimistic.
Well, I wish so, but I think the reality check is necessary in order to light a fire under Democrats. I'm not sure what the strategy should be, and I wish we had an answer here, but I'm looking for an answer because you can't take this lying down. And I thank you again for joining us, David Daly.
Anytime. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Daly, who's a senior fellow for Fair Vote and the author of Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, as well as Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. And he has an article at The Guardian, Republicans Can Win the Next Elections Through Gerrymandering Alone. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the possibility that the U.S. could pull out all of its troops in the Middle East.
Well, I met you on election night, as we cried over our beer. Nothing you could do would cheer me up. We broke up later that year. Well, how come you and I aren't winners?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eugene Goltz, who is a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, who from 2010 to 2012 served in the Pentagon as a senior advisor to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manufacturing and Industrial Base Policy. He also co-wrote the well-known international security article that coined the term restraint as a proposed grand strategy for the United States, and he's the co-author of Buying Military Transformation, Technological Innovation and the Defense Industry, and U.S. Defense Policies, The Origins of Security Policy. And he has a new report at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Nothing Much to Do, Why America Can Bring All Troops Home from the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eugene Goltz.
Thank you much. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And of course, the president met with Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, along with Abdullah Abdullah. And clearly, they're not happy about the U.S. pulling out of Afghanistan as the Taliban makes enormous, very quick territorial gains. And the U.S. intelligence community says that after the U.S. withdrawal on September the 11th of this year, the Afghan government will probably only last about 6 months. But obviously, it just yesterday, there were U.S. airstrikes on three targets, on two in Syria and one on inside Iraq, just inside the Iraqi border with Syria. I'm not quite sure where to begin, Eugene. But what's your sense then of what happened on Friday at the White House?
Well, I certainly don't have any, inside scoop on the internal conversations or anything like that. But, I think there's kind of furious lobbying and pressure to, as there has been for a long time, every time the United States thinks about withdrawing or prepares to withdraw, there's pressure from people who are threatened by that withdrawal to keep us there. I mean, it's pretty strongly in the interest of some people in Afghanistan for U.S. troops to stay there. It just might not happen to be in the U.S. national interest. We may not, it's hard for us to accept that we may not be able to achieve everything that we hoped, but we have to remind ourselves that we've achieved our primary national security interests there, and there's no plausible path to achieving more. And so now we are, kind of responsibly aligning our troop deployments with our national interest, pulling back, thinking about other ways that we can, help prevent the worst possible outcomes. But, there are some things that are beyond our control and some things that are beyond our national interest. And so that's the conversation we're having now, is that we are taking steps in the United States to implement our national interest, and others have other interests and are hoping to persuade us to go along with their interests.
Right, but this has taken 20 years to have this conversation. And, you know, 20 years later, trillions of dollars later, and I think it's over $1 trillion that we've spent in Afghanistan, we have nothing to show for it. It just reminds me of Vietnam.
We have some things to show for it. I mean, let's not exaggerate. I mean, Osama bin Laden was there taking shelter and organizing terrorist acts against the United States. That's not going to happen anymore. Now, it's been 10 years since bin Laden met his end. But so, I mean, you can say this has been a very long, slow process for us to recognize what's in our interest, or what our limited, very limited interests in and limited ability to achieve beyond our core interests in Afghanistan. So it's been slow and it's been very expensive. You're absolutely right. I mean, I too wish that it had happened much faster, but now we are finally taking, very well-reasoned steps, and there still are, negative consequences that we wish were not going to happen, and we just can't stop them, and we can't, we take greater risks by trying to continue futilely. This is a well thought out, slow decision.
Well, but if you go back to the inciting incident, the 9/11 attacks, mm-hmm. and it seemed like we got off on the wrong foot out of the gate. First of all, we didn't unite the world, even though NATO did invoke its Article 5 of its charter. We largely went it alone. We created a war on terror, and essentially we played right into bin Laden's hands. You mentioned bin Laden. I mean, bin Laden was telling the Islamic world that the Crusader armies are coming. Well, guess what? The Crusader armies did show up. It seems to me the whole thing was wrong-footed from the beginning.
Well, I think it's 20 years ago. A lot of this is sort of hazy for many people to look back on. So in 2001, in September and October of 2001, there were pretty significant efforts and, in fact, significant success at uniting the world. You mentioned NATO coming with us, but people were really... Nobody thinks that going and attacking another country, notably the United States, at home... Anyone who does that, nobody thinks they should get a free pass. And, other countries did spend a fair amount of treasure and in some cases blood supporting the effort in Afghanistan. Now, the effort got off on the wrong foot in some other ways. Like, you could imagine things having been much more successful from the get-go. And then you could say the United States got distracted a little bit. In President Obama's memorable word, we took our eye off the ball. We, went to Iraq as well. We lost a lot of global support as a result of that. Things went back, backwards in Afghanistan in various ways. Like, there were a whole series of things that happened over the years. It's been a long time and a lot has happened. I think most people think it was pretty reasonable to go after bin Laden and go after people who made the choice to protect bin Laden when we went to them and said, you know, the Taliban government, when we said, look, bin Laden committed this terrible attack, this terrible crime, atrocity. We have to deal with him. And they sided with him instead of with us, right? That was a fateful choice on their part. But yeah, over the 20 years, there have certainly been plenty of mistakes, both at the tactical and strategic level. I think the thing to focus on now is that, you know, you can't get those back. You can't remedy the mistakes, but you can improve things going forward. You can go back to focusing on aligning what the United States is doing with our military, with our core national interest. And that doesn't involve continuing the war in Afghanistan. And it doesn't involve, you know, in the broader Middle East, you know, continuing these sort of tit for tat attacks with Iranian backed militias like happened over the weekend, or having U.S. troops with, you know, ambiguous goals and exposed positions and in a very challenging environment deployed in the rest of the Middle East at considerable expense and considerable risk, where they're out of position for U.S. national interests and where they're really not protecting against a threat to U.S. national interests. The core, the threats to real U.S. national interests are very low. They're pursuing very ambitious, old, ambitious transformational goals the United States hoped to have in the Middle East that we've seen are really pretty futile and, you know, at least futile to pursue with American soldiers. And so, given that, if you think about the limited number of things that militarily could threaten the United States from the Middle East and the incredible unlikelihood of those things, you can come to the conclusion that really it's time to withdraw, not just from Afghanistan, but from the broader Middle East. It's just not a place where U.S. military deployments are necessary to protect the U.S. national interest.
And again, I'm speaking with Eugene Goltz, who's a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, who from 2010 to 2012 served in the Pentagon as a senior advisor to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manufacturing and Industrial Base Policy. He also co-wrote the well-known international security article that coined the term restraint as a proposed grand strategy for the United States. And he's the co-author of Buying Military Transformation, Technological Innovation and the Defense Industry, and U.S. Defense Politics, The Origins of Security Policy. And he has a new report out at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Nothing Much to Do, Why America Can Bring All Troops Home from the Middle East. Now, the airstrikes that took place over the weekend on the Syrian border and just inside Iraq on the Syrian border, I imagine those aircraft came from the big U.S. base in Qatar. But just to touch on the main points of your paper at the Quincy Institute, Eugene, Nothing Much to Do, Why America Can Bring All Troops Home from the Middle East, you say that the two primary U.S. objectives in the Middle East are preventing the rise of regional hegemons and protecting the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz. Well, first of all, the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz, most of that's going to China, isn't it? So why is it our responsibility?
So responsibility is a pretty loaded word. I mean, some people would say it's within U.S. capabilities, we can do it, and it's good for the United States, right? So the oil, it is true that many oil exports from the Persian Gulf, which go through the Strait of Hormuz, are sold in East Asia, are sold to China, sold to Korea, sold to Japan. They also go to other places, India, other consumers, and not that much as a percentage comes directly to the United States. But the oil market is a global market. So if China did not get to buy oil from the Persian Gulf, if someone had disrupted the Strait of Hormuz, China would go buy oil from someone else. So they would go buy oil from African producers or from Mexico or from Venezuela. They would buy from other producers who the United States currently is buying from. So, you know, any shrinkage of supply to the global market would lead to a readjustment. So even if the particular barrel that's currently being exported from Saudi Arabia to China is the one that gets disrupted. That doesn't prevent China from still wanting to buy and bidding up the price of oil that we buy here in the United States. So it's not so much that China is the direct consumer of Middle East oil. It's that the United States, because we consume so much oil, as does China, as do other countries, but we consume so much oil that we have an interest in ensuring that there are not disruptions of the oil market on the scale that a disruption in the Strait of Hormuz would be. So, you know, you could lose 10 to 20 million barrels a day of supply from the Strait of Hormuz, which would be, you know, 20% of global supply potentially, which of everyday global consumption of oil, which would just have a huge effect in the market. I mean, the most important thing, though, what the paper argues is that this is not a scenario we realistically have to worry about, right? So we have an interest in protecting oil in the Strait of Hormuz because we don't want that to be disrupted and to crash the oil market. However, no one has the ability, no adversary has the ability militarily to really disrupt that oil, such that there's nothing much to do. The U.S. military doesn't have a big mission. There's nothing. We don't have to be deployed there. We don't have to be ready to fight anybody. We don't have to be buying lots of specific equipment. There's no war to fight, because even though it would be terrible if something tragic happened in the Strait of Hormuz, that can't happen, because the military mission that, say, the Iranians would have to prosecute to disrupt all that oil is a very complex, very difficult military mission that is beyond Iranian capabilities and could be defended against by people other than the United States as well.
Well, let's turn to, I mentioned the air base in Qatar, which is the biggest U.S. base there, and I don't know whether you advocate closing that down.
Sure.
Isn't there the potential of these kind of Fort Apache type situations where the U.S. is going to be holed up in the Green Zone in Baghdad? Already, the Iranians have enormous influence in Iraq, and frankly, Iran was the only winner in the Iraq war, as far as I can tell, but they got a new hardline president now, and the noise they're making in response to those attacks that Biden ordered over the weekend are such that they want revenge, etc. But the other Fort Apache, of course, is in Kabul itself. If the IC says that in 6 months after September 11th, when the U.S. pulls out, that the Afghan government will fall, the Turks, as a part of NATO, are defending Bagram Air Base. I just don't know how long you could hold on to that. So what is your strategy then? If the U.S. is going to end up with two Fort Apaches, one in Kabul and one in the Green Zone in Iraq, don't they need that, at least that base in Qatar?
Well, I don't.
Or do you think they just should get out altogether?
Yeah, I mean, well, so in general, I think the United States should get out altogether. But, you know, I would say that U.S. diplomats, so the having embassies, things like that, I wouldn't suggest getting rid of those. I would sort of suggest we have a problem of not having enough consulates, not having too many around the world, right? It's hard for people to get to know U.S. diplomats. It is often the case that, well, not often, but it has been the case in the past that diplomats and embassies can exist in countries with which you do not have friendly relations, or in which there are civil wars, right? It's not an easy tour for the diplomats, but diplomats, you know, take that on. That's part of why they're great patriots serving the country. You know, you don't need a giant air base to preserve, you know, relations with, you know, normal diplomatic relations with other countries, even countries that you know, where you don't get along with the government very well. You know, what I think we don't need are these enormous, you call them, you know, Fort Apaches, the Green Zone in Iraq or presence in Afghanistan have been much, much larger than normal diplomatic presence. They've had, you know, huge security and development efforts that have led to, you know, very trying to protect very large, you know, Western communities that actually threaten lots of locals and you know, lead to difficult you know, culturally threaten or religiously threaten, or, you know, lead to these difficult relationships that you know, those are unnecessarily large targets. And so, I wouldn't suggest trying to maintain a, you know, a U.S. presence of that style in the face of, I mean, I wouldn't suggest trying to maintain that even with U.S. bases, right? Because it doesn't seem to be very productive, right? We're not, that presence is not, quote unquote, winning. So let's do something different. Let's, you know, use the military for what it's for, recognizing what is in the interest and align our deployments with our interests.
Well, Eugene Goltz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Absolutely. Very glad to have this conversation.
And again, I've been speaking with Eugene Goltz, who's a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, who from 2010 to 2012 served in the Pentagon as a senior advisor to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manufacturing and Industrial Base Policy. He also co-wrote the well-known international security article that coined the term restraint as a proposed grand strategy for the United States. And he's the co-author of Buying Military Transformation, Technological Innovation, and the Defense Industry, and U.S. Defense Politics, The Origins of Security Policy. And he has a new report out at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Nothing Much to Do, Why America Can Bring All Troops Home from the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into what seems to be an inevitable takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban and what kind of blowback Pakistan will suffer.
The newborn of a hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flocks from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Madia Afzal, who is a fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, whose research lies at the intersection of political economy, development, and security, with a focus on Pakistan. She's the author of Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society, and the State. And she had an article earlier this month at the Washington Post, What the Biden Administration's Narrative on Afghanistan Gets Wrong. Welcome to Background Briefing, Madia Afzal.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Friday, President Biden met with Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, along with Abdullah Abdullah, its chairman of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation. Not a lot of national reconciliation going on when the U.S. intelligence community says that the Taliban are capturing territory at an alarming rate and that they estimate that after the U.S. withdrawal in September, the current government of Ashraf Ghani's will probably last only 6 months. So a pretty grim picture, is it not?
It certainly is a very grim picture. And even now, the Biden administration's sort of narrative on Afghanistan really seems removed from the reality on the ground. You know, they acknowledge that there is violence. They acknowledge that the situation is bad. But the fact is that that has not changed the calculus of this administration. And it is going to leave Afghanistan militarily. What I think the meeting did accomplish was that President Biden very publicly stood by the, you know, the Kabul government and promised economic, you know, sort of financial security, humanitarian assistance. So basically, you know, the two governments are saying our partnership endures. This is not abandonment. It's just a different kind of phase, which is, you know, which is rhetoric and it is symbolic. Because it's unclear how much that is really going to make a difference, but, you know, sort of in tangible kind of terms, but it's still not insignificant, right? I mean, I think this gesture was hugely important at this time, because without it, it really felt like America was leaving and really abandoning Afghanistan.
But is it throwing good money after bad after a trillion plus dollars have been spent over this, 20-year period? And I don't know. What do we have to show for it?
Right. I mean, I think many would acknowledge the failures, right, of the war in Afghanistan, including the fact, you know, what America says, admits, is that it could not defeat the Taliban militarily. This is why we are where we are. And it has basically acknowledged that. And there are many factors that played a role there. And one factor has been the fact that the Taliban were able to get sanctuary in neighboring Pakistan. So, you know, the fact of the matter is that the Afghan government, of course, has also not been able to sort of get past its decades of corruption and really establish a proper governing body. You know, I think there's sort of this notion that costs in Afghanistan are sunk and we should basically get out. And that is in some ways what we are doing right now by getting out militarily. But there are a couple of things to remember here. One is the fact that, you know, America's responsibilities do not go away when it comes to Afghanistan, because it has made a difference, right? So what do we have to show for it? We have, a lot to show for it in terms of, at least in the urban areas, looking at, you know, sort of human rights, women's rights, you know, how girls are able to go to school, children are able to go to school. You know, they live a very different life from compared to what they did in the 1990s when the Taliban was in power. So we do have that to show for it. And America's responsibility so doesn't only extend to preserving those gains that have been made, but it also extends to the fact that, you know, we, by going into Afghanistan in 2001, began this war in its current iteration. And we have been involved in Afghanistan very much so over the last more than 40 years, starting with when the Soviets invaded the country. And so our responsibility in that country is significant, and we cannot really let it go by saying, look, these are sunk costs. Because when Afghanistan, Afghanistan goes into a spiral, that will affect the region in the very, you know, short and medium term, but it will come back to haunt America, certainly in the medium and long term.
And again, I'm speaking with Madia Afzal, who's a fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, whose research lies at the intersection of political economy, development, and security, with a focus on Pakistan. She's the author of Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society, and the State. And she had an article earlier this month at the Washington Post, What the Biden Administration's Narrative on Afghanistan Gets Wrong. Now, of course, when you say this will come back to haunt the United States, Madia, already the Republicans are seizing on it, and they will, and particularly if we have images of the Taliban being brutal towards women and girls as they take over more of the country. Of course, what they're forgetting, the Republicans conveniently, is that Biden's actually carrying out Donald Trump's policies. But that's not going to matter in the long run. But when you said a bit ago about how the U.S. has acknowledged its failures, has the U.S. acknowledged the role of Pakistan in the sense that it goes beyond, I think, giving sanctuary? I mean, the covert help was pretty enormous. One of the more outrageous examples is that the ammonium nitrate used in the IEDs that have killed and maimed most of the American soldiers, the 2,000 plus who've died in Afghanistan, that ammonium nitrate came from Pakistan, and they refused to supply Afghanistan with an agricultural version that's not suitable for making ANFO, the explosive mixture of ammonium nitrate and diesel fuel. So is there a reckoning to be had there in terms of the extent to which Pakistan continually, at least the army and the ISI, continually stabbed the United States in the back?
Sure. So I think, you know, there are a couple of things to sort of keep in mind there. One is that the United States needs and has needed Pakistan for the last couple of years to bring the Taliban to the table. The Doha peace process that began and ended with the first stage that began with the U.S. and the Taliban talking and then ended with the U.S.-Taliban peace deal that was signed last year, you know, Pakistan was the one that brought the Taliban to the table. And, you know, it's sort of the United States has acknowledged that, and Pakistan has repeatedly said that as well. And in fact, that actual action was what led the U.S. to kind of reset its relationship with Pakistan from a low point, you know, that it had reached at the end of the Obama administration, certainly in the early Trump years, to something of, and again, an uneasy kind of alliance. And so I think the question is, so the U.S. has been kind of studiously quiet on the blaming Pakistan front because it has needed the country. And it continues to need the country now when it is asking Pakistan to sort of push the Taliban to reach a peace deal with the Afghan government, you know, to exercise whatever leverage it has on the Taliban. The problem is, so I think the U.S.'s options are limited when it comes to, you know, how much it can sort of blame Pakistan right now. I think the problem is that now Pakistan's leverage on the Taliban is actually limited because the U.S., by signing a peace deal with the Taliban last year, has given the Taliban international legitimacy. And so Pakistan is needed a lot less by the Taliban, right? So Pakistan's leverage over the Taliban has gone down. Pakistan also, on the other hand, says, look, this war that the U.S. began in 2001, you know, in Afghanistan has had repercussions on Pakistan, right? And so it was part of the reason the Pakistan Taliban rose up and started attacking the Pakistani government and the Pakistani people. And Pakistan lost, you know, tens of thousands of lives because of that. And so, you know, there is sort of this acknowledgement that Pakistan has also paid a price because of the war next door. And so for those reasons, you know, I think, you know, a very public reckoning with Pakistan is not in the offing currently. I think, you know, if things unravel, right, then there might be blame to be had. And I think Pakistan is trying to push back on that, saying, look, the U.S. cannot blame its failures on Pakistan any longer in Afghanistan. And we're trying to do all that we can. And in fact, Pakistan, as you know, all of this is happening, is really trying to reset its image in the world. You know, it's not succeeding in that very much, but it's I think the U.S. is because the U.S. is in sort of a tough place with Pakistan needing it and not being able to sort of publicly blame it, you know, I think Pakistan sort of can maybe slide through at least this time period without much of the failure in the war being blamed on it, at least publicly, at least, you know, by the government officially. You know, plenty of people in Washington obviously look at Pakistan with wary eyes.
But if you take the position that the ISI and the Pakistan military, basically this is the outcome that they wanted. They wanted the Taliban to win all along. If you take that position, then is there a possibility of kind of buyer's remorse that you could end up with a radical state in Afghanistan that could be a reverse sanctuary for the kind of jihadist terrorism that you've just mentioned that the Pakistanis have suffered from, tens of thousands of casualties from the Pakistan Taliban? Is that a danger here?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think Pakistan for a couple of years now, and increasingly publicly in the last year, has been saying it doesn't necessarily want a Taliban government in Afghanistan, right? Or at least a Taliban government that takes over by force. You know, it doesn't want a Taliban military takeover to take place next door. And, you know, its prime minister has been saying this publicly in op-eds and interviews. You know, one may say, well, this might just be the official position. And, you know, Pakistan, you know, underneath it all, the establishment may be happy about this. But I think Pakistan does not want an all-out Islamic Emirate on its western border because of the very reasons you mentioned, because it does not want that necessarily to bleed over into Pakistan and to give legitimacy to the terrorists that were attacking Pakistanis. So, you know, an Afghan Taliban ascendancy or a complete ascendancy in Afghanistan would certainly bolster the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, the TTP, which is already, you know, regrouping and starting to, you know, increase its attacks on Pakistan security forces, you know, in areas where it had sort of been pushed out of. So I think, you know, that is certainly a danger. Pakistan also does not want Afghan refugees coming into the country. And so I think while it does not necessarily want the kind of government that exists in Kabul right now and is very the kind of government that is very friendly with India to be the government that rules on its western border, it also doesn't want the other extreme. It has learned, I think, and it says that it has learned from the past.
But just in the last minute, though, Madia, it looks like they're going to get a Taliban government. Their territorial gains are enormous and they're happening very fast. They are absolutely ruthless, it seems. They say that they no longer have an alliance with Al-Qaeda, and nobody believes that. They say that they're trying to take care of the Islamic State, and nobody believes that. So if it's as bad as it is, and as bad as the American intelligence community says it will be, that they will take over by force, then surely what you've just told us is what Pakistan's going to be facing. So it doesn't seem like you can really negotiate. Even Pakistan can negotiate with the Taliban, that they essentially don't believe in compromise.
Sure. I think the situation looks very grim. And, you know, all of these meetings that have been had and these public pronouncements, you know, ultimately, this may all be rhetoric that cannot change the reality on the ground. And the reality on the ground is grim. And it is that the Taliban are trying to take over militarily. And if that happens, you know, that will be obviously terrible for Afghans. But it will also be a problem next door for Pakistanis who will suffer because of it. And I think Pakistan officially realizes that. And it will be a boon for terrorist groups in the region. And so we are going to see, you know, the threat increase from that part of the world sitting here in the United States as well. I think the world should be watching carefully and be very wary of these developments as they continue to happen so quickly in Afghanistan.
Well, Madia Afzal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Madia Afzal, who's a fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, whose research lies at the intersection of political economy, development and security with a focus on Pakistan. She's the author of Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society and the State. And she had an article earlier this month in The Washington Post, What the Biden Administration's Narrative on Afghanistan Gets Wrong. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.